thank you all for being patient here this morning. Things are starting to clear up. We'll open with, first of all, Pat, any particular announcements for the committee?
No, Madam Chair. The bills that you are looking at today are the last ones that we have available for scheduling, I believe.
Okay, so we may be looking at Thursday as our last meeting. We may be closing up shop, so we'll meet on Thursday and then see where we are at that point. Senate Bill 411, open hearing. And will you brief us on that, Pat?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 411 comes to you from the Senate on a 27-0 vote. The bill has a minimal fiscal impact, but no statement has been issued, and what it would do is change the name of the State Board of Massage Technicians to the State Board of Massage Therapists. We do have a letter for you that came in late yesterday from the Physical Therapist Licensing Board, and I will distribute that at this point.
If you want to speak for the record, okay.
The other material that we sent to your office last night is information that was presented in the Senate.
Okay, and for the record, then, this letter from the Physical Therapist Licensing Board is in opposition to the change of title there to Massage Therapist Board. And the letter states this is an inappropriate change that is misleading to the public regarding the skills, training, and scope of practice of massage licensees. The word therapist implies that the licensee is authorized to provide medical treatments. By definition, a massage technician administers procedures for the purpose of maintaining good health and is prohibited from making a medical diagnosis or curing specific medical problem, and in essence, that is what the statement is from the Physical Therapist Licensing Board. We do not have, I don't believe, anyone here from the.
Stephen Kafori from the.
Oh, all right. I would like to hear then, we have two ladies here, Bev Holzman, Karen McNeese, is that correct? Okay. Would you like to speak to this doll?
Good morning, Representative Loken and members of the committee. My name is Bev Holzman. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Massage Technicians, and sitting next to me is Karen McNeese, licensed massage technician and one of our board members. And we are here today in support of SB 411 for the following reasons. One of the main reasons the board would like to have this name change is it would promote standardization of the title. There are 25 states that offer some type of credentialing to professionals in the massage field. And of those 25 states, 22 incorporate the word therapist in their title. Two use the word technician, and one uses the word practitioner. And there is an attachment, attachment B, which shows all of the states that are involved. Also, the word therapy is used in the statutory definition of massage, ORS 687011, subpart 5, defines massage or massage therapy as the use on the human body of pressure, friction, stroking, tapping, or kneading, and it goes on. But massage therapy is part of that definition. And therapy is also a form of remedial treatment. Massage, as defined, is considered a type of remedial treatment to establish the health and physical condition, and it more adequately describes the type of services provided by a massage technician. Massage is an emerging profession. In 1976, there were 370 licensees. The estimated number by the end of 1999 is 3,600. It is continuing to grow, and it is also continuing to become a more professional, recognized for being more professional, I think. It's a long ways from what people tend to thought of massage in the past. And standardization of the titles also promotes standardization among other states when replying in regard to endorsement for those who wish to come into Oregon from another state where they're a therapist. And it's in that matter and in the national matter. And it's important to note that changing the name does not change the scope of practice. That's not the intent of the bill. And this is supported by an April 7th, 1999 letter from the Attorney General's office, which is attached, which clarifies that there is no change in the definition of what a massage technician would be able to do should the name be changed to therapist. The education hours have continued to grow. Beginning January 1st of this year, they went from 330 hours to 500 hours. The 500 hours are comprised of 200 hours of anatomy and physiology, pathology and kinesiology, and 300 hours of massage theory and practical application, clinical practice, business development, communication and ethics, sanitation, and hydrotherapy. Fiscal impact of a name change would be minimal. The board would use all existing stationery and would process the name into new stationery when it was reordered. That concludes what I have to present at this time. Okay. If you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them, or Ms. McGee.
I would like, you mentioned conformity with other states, and you brought up those that use the word therapist in their definition. What do other states call your profession?
Well, Representative Wilkins, members of the committee, Alabama calls them a massage therapist. Actually, I'll name the ones that use exactly massage therapist.
I'm sure we have this in our list right here.
Oh. Is there a list
attached? It's attached to B.
Morning's list? No, I don't have that.
It has the fact sheet on the front.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. So,
we have therapists used in various forms. Does that mean that all of those then are called massage therapists? A massage therapist, some are called massage practitioner or technician or certified massage therapist. We have a variety of names. All right. Thank you for that. And any other questions? Ready to move? Okay. And would you like to add some comments to this? Or you, Karen, or you?
I think that the list that Ms. Olson has presented speaks for itself. We're trying to bring ourselves into close alignment with national standardization. This is one more way that we can do that. As you'll see, Oregon, Washington, and Utah are only three of 25 states that use other than massage therapy.
All right. Questions? you very much.
Thank you for your time.
And we have Stephen Kafori.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here this morning representing the Physical Therapy Association. We are opposed to Senate Bill 411. We think this is an attempt to expand the practice of massage technicians. Massage technicians were originally licensed as a way to distinguish between people who rub people's fronts and people who rub people's backs. And it was felt at that time that if you had just a minimal amount of education, it would keep prostitutes from calling themselves masseurs, massage technicians, give them a title, and it would be easy to differentiate between legitimate practitioners and those who were illegitimate. And that law has worked pretty well. Since that origination of massage technicians is merely a way of delineating between legitimate and illegitimate, as you've heard, the massage technicians have increased the number of hours, and they are more well-trained than they used to be. However, they are trained in wellness maintenance. That's the reason that we have massage technicians, and that's the definition given in the statute. Therapy, on the other hand, denotes treatment of an illness or an injury. We think that changing this name gives a false impression to the public that massage technicians are trained to treat. We, as physical therapists, use massage technicians in our clinics, but they do not practice under their own license. They practice under our physical therapy licenses, under the supervision of a master's degree physical therapist who's trained to diagnose, evaluate, and prescribe treatment where there has been an injury or a physical problem. The Board of Medical, the Board of Massage Technicians, OAR 334-10-025, specifically states the practice of massage does not include D, making a medical diagnosis, or E, the intent to cure specific medical problems. You got a letter this morning from the Board of Physical Therapy. They have written a number of times to the Board of Massage Technicians complaining about massage technicians who are doing things they're advertising. If you look in the phone books, there are a lot of massage technicians who are now advertising as massage therapists. And we think they're advertising and practicing in ways that go beyond what their scope is. And for example, I have was given to me just today an advertisement to come for a sports injury class, course for massage therapists and athletic trainers interested in understanding sports injuries and chronic pain. And we think this is the direction that the massage technicians are attempting to go by changing the name to massage therapists to get into such things as treating sports injuries. And we feel that those sports injuries are the kind of injuries that need a physical therapist and not a person who is trained as little as massage technicians are and who are trained very well for what they do, but what they do is wellness and not therapy.
All right. Questions of Mr. Kafori? What would you see as a difference in the training and education? How extensive is that for a physical therapist as compared to?
I'm sure a physical therapist has a master's degree, and they go, I guess, it's 6 years to school. And then if they want to practice independently in terms of receiving direct patients directly rather than by referral, they take additional courses and continuing education.
And does a physical therapist practice under the direction of a physician or doctor, or do they?
Madam Chair, we have gradually over the years moved as we've had. We started out as physical therapists were people who were just minimally trained, and as we've gotten more training and gotten into a master's degree licensure, then we have passed a law that allows us to practice independently from physicians, but only if we take special classes that teach diagnosis, because the originally physical therapists were not trained to diagnose. So if a physical therapist wants to do independent practice, that is to receive patients without a referral from a physician, They must have special classes and take continuing education in diagnosis.
And you don't see this, any of this, as being necessary then with a massage technician? Do you feel that if the word therapist was applied to massage instead of technician be massage therapist, you're feeling that the public might be misled and assuming that it would be care that is more trained, would provide training?
Madam Chair, that's exactly our concern. We think that the word therapy has a very specific meaning, and therapy means to take someone who is not well and make them well, or at least attempt to make them well, and we don't think that's what the role of massage technicians are.
Right. Yes,
just one question. Mr. Troy, I got a list of the 22 states where it has that name. Do they have problems in those 22 states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, we have problems right here in the state of Oregon. I don't have to go to other states to find problems. As I said, we have had the Board of Physical Therapists send a number of letters, and we're very concerned about the expansion that's occurring today here in Oregon of massage technicians practicing outside what their license is, and we think that does cause problems, yes.
Representative Piercy.
Thank you. It just occurs to me, though, that since there is a scope, and this isn't changing the scope, that if they practice outside of their scope, whether it's being called a technician or a therapist, the problem is the same. So, and since I'm reading here that the word therapy is already used in this statutory definition and that the AG's office says that this won't change anything that they're doing in practice right now, I can't really see how it seems to me if someone's practicing outside their scope, they can be challenged about that right now. This won't change.
Madam Chair, Representative Piercy, what we're concerned about is the public impression. If you put a sign outside your door that says massage therapy, or put an advertisement in the phone book that says massage therapy, we think that what that says to the public is if you've had an injury of some kind, or if you've got a chronic condition of some kind, here's a place to go and seek relief.
But by law, they would still be confined to the scope of practice that they are currently confined to.
Madam Chair, Representative Piercy, in theory, that's correct. In practice, we're finding that's not the case.
Ms. Enloe?
A couple of things. One is I have suffered an automobile injury, and the doctor sent me to a place where I got massage therapy. It was marvelous. And really was therapeutic. So the name seems to make logical sense to me. But the question that I have for you, Steve, is your opening remarks mentioned prostitution and lotion part. You didn't use the word lotion part, but I prefer to use that to what one of the other options might be for me to say to describe that particular business. And doesn't it seem to you that any step that we take in the direction of helping these people professionalize their image is going to be in the public service, be in the interest of the public, because helping them professionalize their image with the word therapist instead of technician is going to put further distance between themselves and those lotion parlors activities, I think.
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, two questions. Let me take the second one first. We think that massage technicians makes it pretty clear that these are not people who are recreational therapists, that these are people who are...
Thank you. I like that term.
We think that we've gotten there now. We have pretty strict requirements. There was a licensing board. There are education requirements and licensing by the state. The title of massage technician, we think, very clearly distinguishes them. We don't think there's anything necessary to do that. And further, regarding your treatment that you had, you'll notice that you started off by saying that you went to the MD doctor first and got diagnosed and then were sent. That's our concern. We have no problem with doctors sending people to have a massage. What we do have a problem is people thinking they can go directly to a massage practitioner, a massage technician, and get treatment without going to the doctor first and getting a diagnosis. That's our concern. And what I can foresee, for example, would be your story told to somebody else, Representative Piercy, is in an automobile accident this afternoon, and she has a very stiff neck. She said, well, I heard from Representative Lowe that she went to a massage therapist and got therapy and was well, so I think I'll go to massage therapy as therapist and get well as well, skipping that step. And we think that this is what we're concerned about.
Follow-up. So the real concern is who's going to get the customer?
Madam Chair, Representative Lowe, our concern is who's going to do the evaluation and say, yes, this is a problem for which a good massage would really help, or no, this is a problem that requires something else. And that's what diagnosis and evaluation is all about. And that's why we, as physical therapists, take special courses in diagnosis before we can see patients without a referral.
Were you through?
I'm pretty familiar with physical therapy because I have a daughter who is a physical therapist, and probably have to declare a conflict of interest. But I know the training that she has. She has a master's. She works through a hospital a lot and treats people who have, you know, had surgery or other very severe illnesses, and it's far from being a massage. And I just wonder if that, could a massage technician, do you think, be able to function in that situation?
Madam Chair, we feel there are very different roles for different people in the whole healthcare spectrum, and that we have laws delineating practice and scope license in those. We think that it works pretty well right now. We would like to see the titles practice. And that's why we're opposed to this bill.
All right. Any other questions, any witness? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wish we can go into work session. Close the hearing. Work session.
Chairman, I move passage of Senate Bill 411 with the passed recommendation.
Discussion. I will be a no vote on this. I think that we are extending this scope of practice into therapy, which is really akin to being more of a medical procedure.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I see massage. I don't get confused in thinking I'm going for medical treatment. Whether you call it a technician or a therapist, it's still massage. Mm-hmm. And I think to think anything else is assuming a level of stupidity that Oregonians don't have.
And
well, I agree. I don't agree with you. I think if you have call a doctor, and you call someone who gives a massage a doctor, or even a therapist a doctor, that you're stepping outside of the profession.
Well, Madam Chair, I would agree with Representative Cruz that I have faith in the public that they know the difference between the two. We call veterinarians doctors, but I don't think people confuse veterinarians with MDs. And
the doctor's of jurisprudence. And going to come to me.
I think that
the control manager.
There's at least 22 states.
No, I think the rest of our members, except for Representative Gardner, have the floor.
And I think there are 22 states that currently use, you know, this title, and I don't believe the people in those states are confused either. It looks like it would be just more in conformity with other states out there.
Yes.
I'm sure. I really don't care. I think it's a waste of our government's time and money to even think about doing something like this. By any other name, they can be anything they want to. So let's get on with it and get some stuff done that needs to be done. I'll vote yes, probably no on the floor. Let's get it out. Let them have an opportunity to present it.
Any other?
Going.
Is that a move to the previous question?
No, I won't move the previous question.
Okay, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Gardner, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Knope?
Aye.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Montgomery?
Aye.
Representative Piercy?
Aye.
Chair Logan?
No. The ayes have it, and Senate Bill 411 goes to the floor with a do pass recommendation. All right, and the carrier for the bill?
I'd be happy to.
All right, Representative Gardner.
That way I don't get stuck with the other three.
Ready? So that was the work session. Bill 411, open a hearing on. With the permission of the committee, we will change the order here to Senate Bill 479. This is a bill that has been sponsored by Senators Gordley and Shields, and I believe Senator Shields is here. So we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 479. Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for taking this now. I was prepared to wait a while. I do have another bill in another committee and need to keep moving. Senator Gordley and myself brought this bill forward because, on my part, I'm a clergyman in real life when I'm not down here in what one might refer to as an unreal life. But over the years, we've done everything we can to try to help homeless individuals. And a lot of churches have parking lots and have expressed the idea. And I've talked to clergy men and women in various churches. And they, in those parking lots, during the week, they're not crowded. They would have room and could easily handle maybe one or two or three cars with a family of homeless individuals to be able to sleep in their cars temporarily. This is not a great thing. This is just kind of a temporary thing. This is permissive language. It allows a city to permit churches to have some of their parking lot used for those homeless families as long as they have sanitary facilities inside. Now, there are advocates for the bill that are here that know the bill much better than I and who can describe why it's permissive, why we had an amendment that changed must to may and all of that stuff, okay? It's basically a patterned after something that's worked very successfully in Eugene. I think it's a good humanitarian thing to do. Until we can get to the point in this country where we can really eliminate homelessness and deal with the issues that create homelessness, this is a good, positive kind of interim step to take. And I would hope that you would listen to the advocates and pass this bill, and I'd just be glad to be of any help along the way that I can. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. Representative Montgomery.
Thank you. Senator, I read here on one of the letters that the city of Eugene is currently doing that. Is that correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up question I made.
Yes.
I have no problem with it, but if the city of Eugene is doing it, why do we need a law to tell other cities they can do it and they can already do it?
The advocates will explain that in a few minutes in more detail, but to give you the answer from 30,000 feet. Permissive language will permit cities like the city of Portland to bypass a whole lot of conditional use permit processes. For instance, it's very similar to a bill, actually an ordinance in Portland, where a church could cite a homeless shelter or a transitional housing unit in a church building, but they used to have to go through an inordinate number of processes to get a conditional use permit to do so. So we got the city of Portland to pass an ordinance that allows churches to do that without going through a long process. And I think you'll hear a better answer certainly than I can give from Jerry Bieberly and maybe somebody from HEMO or somebody.
Yeah.
I don't want to come off real negative on this, but what's to stop somebody in a great big 40-foot, $300,000 motorhome for doing it? They do it in my community all the time, and we're tired of it. If they got that fancy a rig, they can go pay $22 and stay someplace and not in the church parking lot.
Okay, number one, if somebody pulls into a church parking lot, and I've had this kind of problem in the past, churches where I've been, they usually don't ask permission. They just pull in at night and park and hope nobody notices them, and they avoid the cost of a campground fee. Number one, it's permissive. It doesn't require a church to do anything. It doesn't require the city to even permit it. Okay? It just, it's permissive. It allows them to do it if they want to. Number two, that individual that does that is doing something without the permission of the church. The church would not normally give permission for that kind of an occurrence. And in the city of Portland, most of the things that we do very carefully in relationship with our neighborhood association. So we're in dialogue with our neighborhood association about just about anything that happens. So if a motorhome came into our parking lot and we didn't notice it, by golly, the neighborhood association would notice it and would say, hey, what's that guy with a 40-foot rig doing in your parking lot? And at that point, because we want to maintain a positive relationship with our neighborhood association, we would talk to that individual, and that one night stay would be nothing more than a one night stay.
Just one follow up.
All right.
In urban areas, I understand, in a rural community, we're at best 30 miles from a policeman.
Mm-hmm.
So who's going to tell these bad guys to get out? That's our problem in small communities. We don't have a law enforcement officer in the city of Cascade Locks. Closest one's Hood River, which is 22 miles away. And we sure don't want to call the sheriff to come down and say, get this motorhome out of there with some guys off murdering and raping people. So
yeah.
I think there's a balance of the small communities that have a major problem.
Yeah. Well, if I were the pastor of a local church in Cascade Locks and somebody pulled a motorhome onto my property, I would, in a very polite way, go talk to them and say, the community has real concerns about you leaving or parking here. Would you please move on? And then I would leave and give them about 15 minutes to pick up and get out, and then I would call the state police. I'm just saying, if I were in the position that you described, the pastor of a church, and I've been one for 28 years, has responsibility for not only his congregation, but for the church's property. So that's how I would handle it if I were in your community.
Thank you. And, Pastor, I understand that. I've been a port manager for 10 years. They talk to pastors a lot different than they talk to port managers.
Yeah, until they become politicians, and then it's all over. Are there any other questions?
Me?
I'm sure that the advocates themselves have much better answers than I do. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. All right, Gerald Beverly. And I wonder if Gerald Beverly and Donald Lamb could come up together.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name's Elder Jerry Beverly, and I'm here today representing the RNA Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. My written testimony has been passed out very similar to the letter that I gave you earlier or later last week in sort of preparation for this hearing. Where are the requesters of Senate Bill 479? We talked to Senators Gordley and Shields during the interim and worked on this. And indeed, it's patterned after the City of Eugene's ordinance. The question is, what good is it anymore once we took MUST out and put in Maine? There's good reasons why we took out MUST, and you don't have to go into those. But what you get, and I think Phil Fell will talk about it, is it saves over 200 jurisdictions, both cities and counties, from going to the expense and the bother of each passing their own individual ordinance to allow this, then having to deal with each individual church that wishes to do it, having to go through a conditional use permit, zoning laws, all kinds of other things. All it does is facilitates it, makes it easier, makes it simpler. Now, what it does is that we have a lot of folks out there who are camping in vehicles, campers or cars. Most of them are families. What it does is it gives us an opportunity to get them off the street. Right now, you find them under bridges in parks, gosh knows where. What we're trying to do is give them an opportunity where we can get them into a church parking lot, where we can then engage them and try to then move them into some kind of interim housing so we can get them out of the vehicles. It's not viewed to be a campground where people will stay for any significant period of time. It also would make it safer for those folks during that interim period. We would like to really emphasize that when we amended the bill, and I frankly admit I was trying to push the envelope and found out I had pushed it much too far. The original draft said must. That didn't fly for very good reasons. And when I sat and thought about it, I agreed that may is much better because there's no sense in trying to push somebody into something they don't want to do. The bill authorizes but does not require religious organizations to seek this permission. So it does not mean that if I'm a homeless camper and I see a church parking lot, I can just pull in and say, well, I can do that now because the legislature authorized it. The legislature does not authorize it. It authorizes the church to seek it. It does not authorize it. It authorizes but not require the local jurisdiction to grant permission. There's times I think that a church may ask for this and it's inappropriate and the jurisdictions can say no. We've done things to try to limit it. We limited it to 3 vehicles. The idea is we didn't want churches to be overwhelmed with 10, 20 people coming in and asking for assistance. And we also in the bill said that they had to have sanitary facilities available. So there's plenty of safeguards in there. One of the questions that came up in the Senate was, I forgot what the question was. One of the questions was a religious institution. We say churches, synagogues, and other religious institutions. What we were thinking about when we put that in there was things like Buddhist temples, friends meeting houses, maybe seminaries. We were not thinking that somebody could just say, okay, I'm a church now and I got a parking lot and you can come here would qualify. One of the questions was, what if the community doesn't like it? Well, the reality is, as Senator Shields was talking about, I can't think of a better community-based organization than a church. And I don't know many churches that are out of tune with their community or neighborhood, but if they were, the city could revoke that permission. So I would emphasize to you that it's permissive. It doesn't require anything, but it makes it a lot easier, and that's why we stopped the bill. There is, attached to my testimony, I think you probably have it submitted independently, a letter from the city of Eugene, Richie Wyman, shows how it operates in Eugene. And that's what we anticipate. We anticipate a partnership between the churches and the social service agencies, where the social service agency would be the screener, the referrer, that, you know, when a homeless family is looking for a place, they can say, well, we got a slot in this church over here on 3rd and Main. Why don't you go over there? And then they call ahead of time and make that arrangement. We don't see it where people circulate to the neighborhood looking for a church parking lot and hope for the best. And with that, I would...
All right. Thank you, Mr. Beverly. Any questions? Representative Pearson?
Thank you. Well, you know, I come from the community that does this, so I've been there and seen that it's worked very well in Eugene. Comments that I have, Jerry, is that in this it says that any political subdivision of the state may allow churches, synagogues, and so in fact the community has to give permission for this to take place. Is that, that's in the language, right?
And Chair Representative Percy, that is absolutely correct.
The other concern that I have is that in this packet of information we have today, there's a letter that was given to in the Senate side on from the state bar saying that the language in the bill suffers from constitutional problems and that it singles out religious groups for special treatment different from that afforded any non-religious group. This creates a potential problem under First Amendment Establishment Clause. Do you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's the very first I heard of it, so it catches me. I haven't any idea what, you know, what I don't understand it.
It says we would recommend that, if I may.
Yes, I'm wondering if someone is here from the civil rights section of the state bar. Evidently not. We have the, do all committee members have this letter? Okay. Did you, please go on then, if you had another comment.
Well, they, my understanding of this is that they just think it treats religious institutions different from other properties that might decide they wanted to do this. But I, I don't know that Eugene's run into any problems in doing this. So you might comment on that.
Chair Loken, members of the committee, I'm Donald Lamb, and I'm the volunteer board chair for St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County, Inc., which, in cooperation with the city of Eugene, administers and is the vehicle in which the religious institutions and others in Eugene implement this policy. And to give you a little background, the parking by homeless individuals, initially Eugene decided that the appropriate spot, because of the community saying not in my backyard for all practical purposes, we want it over in the industrial section. So it went to the industrial section. And we had numerous problems. The cost to the police department rose dramatically. Neighbors, those in the industrial park said that they were losing business and couldn't function. Make a long story short, we looked for an alternative. And one of them was the idea to utilize church parking lots. And the reason we chose that is that St. Vincent de Paul had an existing program for certain families, what we call our night shelter program, where we took families in, worked with them during the day, and then in the evening they went to different religious institutions for lodging, and then were brought back. And as Jerry indicated, that we had these large parking lots which could be available if it was properly screened. So what we did was to bring the police force together with this permissive permit, in which a homeless person in a vehicle with the permission of the church goes to a particular and is permitted to reside on that religious institution's parking lot. That church, synagogue, temple, they controlled how long it stayed there, whether it stayed there, and the whole conditions as to what could go on. The thing that was required was obviously sanitary services and water being available. It has worked extremely well. It's been a very good cooperation between the community and those that cared. And Mr. Weinman made a little remark there in the middle of a second page, and he said the solution was simple. We got out of the way of helping people, letting them help people. And so it was that coordination. If people become unruly, we talk to them. If they continue to be unruly, they're cited and the police come in. That's how it works. So the neighbors are happy. Everybody seems to be working.
How much was this used in the church?
I believe in the neighborhood of 200 individuals.
At various churches.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And problems were mental?
We've had, to the best of my knowledge, we have had one incident. Where we've had to have the police involved and the person removed under duress, so to speak. Other than that, we haven't. So it's been extremely successful, and it's about two and a half years old, I think. Very good program.
Excuse me. Hello.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don, I was wondering if we could get around our constitutional challenge here by... And I don't know what our time frame is in terms of amending these things.
Very, very.
Yeah,
it's
very
probably
marginal.
Not at all.
Might have to skate real quick here. But if you had asked for to allow any not-for-profit civic or community center, including but not limited to churches, synagogues, temples.
Actually, in Eugene, Madam Chair, Representative Lowe,
yes.
In Eugene, we with permission of individuals. It's anywhere. It happens to be religious, but there are private additional lots in which we have people parking on with consent of private owners. So it's wide open. It just doesn't get the notice that the... and since it's one, two, or three, if they have space, they... and the facilities. So in Eugene, it is wide open, although it's predominantly utilized by the religious institutions.
Representative Piercy, did you have your hand up?
No, I didn't.
All right. Representative Montgomery.
I know we're not in work session, but we're constitutional problems. I see another one. Unless they wanted it this way, a political subdivision, a port to the political subdivision. Any place that elects people to serve on commissions, which we have a lot of in rural Oregon, are political subdivisions. I know you mean city or counties, and you best say it, or we're really opening that door to a whole bunch of folks, too. And I don't, unless you met ports and things of that nature, and I don't think you did.
Madam Chair, Representative Montgomery, that's what Legislative Council wrote. We said we wanted cities and counties, and they wrote political subdivisions. And
okay.
No. But... I, no offense, but I don't think any churches and so relevant.
We have Legislative Council come in pretty soon and talk to us about this. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, both of you. And Mrs. Bell, Oregon Cities, are you? Yes. And Ellen Lowe, would you both like to come up, please?
Madam Chair, committee members, Philip Bell from the League of Oregon City. The League is supportive of this bill and concept. We agree with the comment on city-county, and I assume that Legislative Council will tell us that we're acting under that definition in this case. We appreciate the fact that the local government can decide whether to allow this. That allows us to kind of mediate around the community with the church in the neighborhood as necessary. So we think this is one of those local programs that may turn out to work very well when extrapolated around the state, depending on the resources of the community.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Montgomery.
Just for a clarification, if I could help me understand a little better. The city of Eugene can do it now and is doing it now. So why do we need to pass a law to allow other cities to do something they can already do?
Madam Chair, Representative Montgomery, as I think a previous speaker alluded to the fact that there are a variety of land use activities that an applicant would have to go through to be able to allow people to essentially camp on a church lot for a few overnights. So this just cuts through all that and says you have the authority to do it.
You mean a police could not, if they saw someone camping somewhere, could not come in and verify whether they could camp there or not?
No, I don't mean that. I'm sure the police can always do that.
Yeah. But the city could also.
Right.
Madam Chair, Representative Montgomery's question, I think what we really have here is we have so many laws now that people can't do things that are common sense activities, so we have to pass more laws to allow common sense to happen.
Thank you for the clarification.
I'm with you. I think that we do too much of it. When you have 4,000 proposals for laws and we pass somewhere up to 1,000, I think it's overburdening the citizens of this state. Okay, any other questions of the witnesses? Excuse me, Ms. Lowe.
Chair Loken and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I serve as Director of Public Policy for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, 16 denominations representing some 1,200 congregations, and actually a lot of our congregations have expressed interest in this kind of activity. Many of them have shelters in their basements, And I will admit to being the person who first went to Mr. Beverly and said, we better change must to may, because the experience of our congregations across the state has been that when they have had shelters or joined together to provide shelters, it's been extremely important that they work with the local jurisdiction. And I recall particularly a number of years ago hearing from a couple of congregations in Burns that do provide shelter, and most of the time the people who are referred to them are referred to them by the local police or the local sheriff. And so there is this kind of contact that exists. The other is that congregations very much want to be able to communicate with the local support network, so that indeed this really is a very short-term occupancy of a parking lot that leads to connecting that family with the supports that exist within the community. And we're very supportive of Senate Bill 479 and encourage you to send it to the floor with a two pass. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Appreciate your coming forward.
Thanks.
I think we have someone from Legislative Council here that can clarify some of the questions for us. Jeff Taylor, all right. Good morning. Thanks for coming up.
Good morning, Chair Loken, members. I'm Chuck Taylor from Legislative Council, and I did the drafting on Senate Bill 479. I know the Bar Civil Rights Group has raised a question about the constitutionality on the bill because it does speak about religious institutions. I agree that there's a possibility that it is a violation of the Establishment Clause. I think that's the case with a lot of things that we pass out of the legislature. The question is, how great a possibility? And that really is a little hard to answer. One reason that it's hard to answer is because U.S. Supreme Court Establishment Clause cases tend to kind of flip-flop around a little bit, and it would depend, I think, in part on what test they use to analyze the situation. For a great many years, they have off and on used a test called the Lemon Test, and under the Lemon Test, you would look at whether the law has a purpose of promoting religion, or whether it is for some secular purpose, trying to correct some kind of a social problem. The second thing you would look at is whether it has the effect of somehow benefiting religion and promoting religion. And in that, you would be looking mainly at the direct benefit and not something that's incidental or kind of a secondary fallout thing. And the third thing you would look at is whether there is an excessive entanglement between the government and the religious institutions as a result of the law. An instance of that would be if the religious institution were spending government funds or carrying out some kind of a government program or something like that. Or in the opposite way, if the government were carrying out a religious function. Mm-hmm. Over the last few years, they have also tended to be developing a test called the endorsement test. And in that, you look first at the entanglement issue. And then secondly, you would look at the whether the law causes a reasonable person who is in the excluded group to feel that they have been diminished in some way as a member of the political community, that they've been essentially given a second would a reasonable person feel they've been given a second-class status by virtue that this other group can do something that they can't? I think under the lemon test, we're okay. Under the endorsement test, I think there's a question there. And that's why I say there's a possibility it's unconstitutional. Just to complicate matters a little more, they don't always follow either one of those tests. And sometimes just call them useful and then proceed with a different analysis altogether. One of my favorite quotes from that area of law is Justice Souter was talking about the use of tests in the U.S. Supreme Court and observed that whatever test you use, you eventually have to apply it to the facts. And he noted that the U.S. Supreme Court, which is responsible for saying what the law is, when they go to apply the law to a set of facts, manage to come out with opinions that run all over the map. And I think in the in that particular case, there were like four differing opinions on what the outcome should be among the nine justices. As far as Oregon case law, I think probably Oregon law is a little more in line with the endorsement test than the lemon test, and so you might find a greater likelihood that the Oregon Supreme Court would strike it down than under the U.S. Supreme Court. Like I say, it's a little hard to really pin down what the likelihood is. I think as far as the federal government goes, the court tends to pick what result they want to get, and then they pick the analysis that's going to get them there, mm-hmm. basically.
I wonder if common sense ever plays a part.
Well, I think...
You shouldn't have asked that, should
no,
you?
No, don't
have
my, my question was, under the common sense test, let's move on with it. Let churches put them in there if they want to, and let the attorneys make more money. They can sue one another, but let's get on with it and let them do it.
I think there probably is kind of a smell test there. They're basically going to be looking at it from a common sense standpoint and what it's trying to do. And I think that does enter into it and what analysis they pick. As far as the suggestion from the bar that this could be broadened out by removing the reference to religious institutions, that is true that the broader you make the group, if you extend it beyond religious institutions, you eliminate or reduce the possibility of an Establishment Clause challenge. Certainly, if you say religious institutions or benevolent or charitable institutions, that may get you outside of it. And if you were to do what the bar is saying and just say any institution, and of course that would definitely eliminate the problem. It's a question of how much risk do you perceive, and what are the countervailing social policies that might keep you from wanting to expand it. And that's getting into a policy area that I won't try to intrude into. But...
All right.
I guess that's the best answer I can give you about the legal status of the thing, and if there are specific legal questions,
well.
I'd be glad to try and answer those.
Okay. Questions, Representative Piercy?
Madam Chair, I know this program's worked well in Eugene. I don't have any problem with it. I'm glad to move on with it, and Representative Montgomery, if something comes up, let them deal with it out there.
Take your chance at the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Madam Chair, the Eugene is a lot different than what we're talking about, though. Eugene does not say religious. Eugene,
it's broader.
I think, says business and others. So like that. This person may have a point, Madam Chair, but the State Bar of Oregon is no different than any other group that comes before us. They're just an association out there, and that's all they are. They're a union for attorneys. So it's no different than the League of Oregon Cities or other people from before. That's their opinion. So to go with this in the 35 cents, we can make a phone call. I think we should move ahead. There's no time to amend these bills. And if the cities want to do it, let's let them do it and get it over here.
Are we in work session?
No, we are not.
Can we get there?
Certainly. If you folks will just quit talking, I'll put the hammer down.
Thank you.
No, we'll have to work this.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 479.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor.
To the floor with a due pass record.
Okay. Discussion.
Speaking as a member of the bar, which is just another organization, however, it governs lawyers and yanks your chain if you misbehave or anything like that, it is repugnant to me to willingly pass a law. I know that it's going to be unconstitutional. However, I'm willing to hold my nose, take a deep breath, and vote aye. So let's do it.
Madam Chair. No, I agree with Representative Montgomery. You know, we have so perverted the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment from what original intent is that we're bringing all sorts of things under that and bringing them into question. I don't think this even comes close. So I think we should just pass the bill.
Let's just hold on to the lemon then.
All right. Would the clerk call a roll? Well, first of all, do we have a... Did we have a motion to pass the bill?
Yes, I
all right,
I made that motion,
Madam Chair. With a due pass?
With a due pass.
Okay. Well, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Gardner, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Stokes?
Aye.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Montgomery?
Aye.
Representative Piercy?
Aye.
Chair Loken?
Aye. And let the record show Representative Cruz is not able to be here today. She is excused. And so, having received the majority of votes, Senate Bill 479 is passed to the floor with a due pass. Representative Knope, would you like to say this bill? Can you do it without holding your nose?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. That closes the work session on Senate Bill 479. Senate Bill 197. We'll hear next. 9:30. If our session is at 10, and we run into a little time frame with 202, we may not be able to finish that bill.
Sheriff, I may just have a question. 202 is going into work session. I think it was just a housekeeping matter, getting an order so we could read it.
No, it was more than that. It turned out to be more than that. Uh-huh.
Okay, well then.
Yes. We don't have agreement on that.
Okay.
So, from there. All right. Senate Bill 197. To brief us on that.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 197 came to you from the Senate on a 28-1 vote. The no vote was Senator Weil. The bill includes corporations, partnerships, and limited liability companies in the definition of investment holding companies. It clarifies that the company has the powers and authorities granted by laws of the jurisdiction in which it was established. It specifies qualifications for officer, director, member, or manager of the company. And we have an expert witness here, Madam Chair.
Very good. Thank you.
Explain that better.
Ms. Logan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sharon Peebles. I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon State Treasury in support of Senate Bill 197. This amendment basically has three primary purposes. One is substantive, the remainder are probably housekeeping. The existing statute, 293.778, permits the Oregon State Treasurer to establish title holding corporations, investment holding companies, as used in the statute. We have interpreted the words investment holding company to include both corporations and partnerships. Since the original statute was enacted in 1993, the Oregon legislature passed legislation creating a third type of entity, a limited liability company. These companies are fairly simple to operate and would be very beneficial, I think, to Treasury's operation on behalf of its investment funds. This particular Senate Bill 197 would clarify that investment holding companies includes limited liability companies. We can't take the position that it currently includes investment holding companies since they didn't the limited liability companies didn't exist when the statute was passed. So that's the substantive change that Senate Bill 197 would make to the existing statute. Secondly, again, it's the definition of investment holding company. Holding company implies perhaps that these business entities are totally passive and can do nothing other than hold title to investments. Excuse me. Real estate investments are typically not passive. The companies, be they partnerships, LLCs, or corporations that hold these investments, execute leases, they execute service contracts, they enter into management agreements, and perhaps more often than we like, are often sued and must sue. The housekeeping aspect of this bill would clarify that holding companies have all of the powers and authority of the jurisdiction under which they're formed. And indeed, that merely clarifies what these holding companies have been doing in the past, and that is actively engaging in business operations. Mm-hmm. Lastly, the current statute provides that personnel of the Oregon State Treasury may be appointed as officers and directors of these business entities. As a result of that may language, we have hesitated to name other parties in corporate positions. And for practical and legal reasons, we are requesting that that may be clarified to specifically state that third parties other than officers and employees of the Oregon State Treasury may serve as members, partners, officers, directors of these business entities.
Where you're speaking of may, is that on line 12 of the
correct
bill?
Correct.
Questions of the witness? I don't, this seems to be a bill that has come through the Senate in good shape and actually without an amendment. So I don't see any purpose in amending it now unless other members of the committee have a different idea. But I think we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 197 and open the work session. Do I have a motion to move?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 197 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. You have heard the motion. Discussion. Representative Cruz, would you? Excuse me, we're too far. Let's vote on this bill, and then we'll have a carrier. Be prepared, Representative Cruz.
Representative Gardner, how do you vote? Representative Gardner, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Cano?
Aye.
Representative Cruz?
If I vote aye, does that mean I have to carry it?
Maybe it does.
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Absent. Excuse.
Representative Montgomery?
Aye.
Representative Pearson?
Aye.
Representative Chair Loken?
Aye. D-197 received the majority of votes.
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate that. All right.
We seem to have had a work.
We have? Yes. That makes it easy. Next is the work session on Senate Bill 197. And we have one more bill here, Senate Bill 202, and we've had lots of discussion on this one, and work session on Senate Bill 202, and we have some folks here, several amendments, and would like to hear from, I think we have some letters too. All right. Would you like to discuss what has occurred?
Back to the beginning. Senate Bill 202A came to you from the Senate on a 25-0 vote. At that time, the bill had been amended to delete some exemptions. Those would be restored in a set of amendments before you, but I understand that an informal work group out here has agreed that those will not be going forward. So the amendments that the board and Mr. Anton have agreed to place before you for consideration today are the dash 2 and the dash 4 amendments, which I provided you. I do have some letters from members of the board of investigators prior to this, what looks like a mini work group that has accomplished quite a bit while they've been sitting in the audience. And so I will distribute those letters so that you can have them for your file.
Right.
The bill has no fiscal or revenue impact. The dash 2 amendments would allow licensed investigators and registered operatives access to vital statistics upon request. Mr. Steele is in the audience and will respond to a question from the chair. The dash 4 amendments changes financial institution to insured institution, and this was necessary to conform statute language that came about in the revisor's bill this session. The dash 4 amendments also clarify language related to bond, letter of credit, and errors of and omissions insurance.
All right, thank you very much. So you may ignore the dash 3 amendments, and I would like to ask, we did not hear last time from any member of the board except for the president board, and I think that we have someone here, and I would like to ask Sam your board member to come forward, and also, and then we'll want to hear from Mr.
Seeley.
Mr. Seeley from DMV.
Mm-hmm.
We also have Mr. Fenton here from someone that testified last time.
Mr. Anton.
Yeah, okay. All right. So we have been puzzling over these amendments, and we wanted to make sure. I have been very concerned that we not pass something that the board has not had ample time to study and to reach agreement upon. And I did not feel, and the committee did not feel last time, that that had been accomplished. So now we're here, and we need to move forward with this because we don't have time left in our work here in the committee to pursue other amendments. So I'm hoping that from your discussion this morning that you can come back to us and give us something that we need in order to pass the bill.
And members of the committee, my name is Elaine Hamm. I'm the interim executive director of the Board of Investigators. And with me is Bruce Daly, who's also a member of the board, of Investigators. And we'll be happy to answer your questions. I think there is concurrence on the dash 2 amendments and the dash 4 amendments among all the board members, as Mr.
Wilson stated. Okay. Were those amendments accurate as stated as to what they accomplished?
Yes, I believe
you want to,
dash 2 pertains to vital statistics and access to those. And yes, as you stated, dash 4 has to do with the language surrounding the E&O insurance issue that we discussed last time.
Uh-huh. And now this this gives the E&O insurance as an option then. So it doesn't rule out the previous language, which included surety bond.
That's correct.
And I believe there was another item.
Irrevocable letters of credit.
Right.
The other option.
So it's adding the errors and omission as an options as an emission insurance. Okay. And then on the dash 4s, you're in agreement with those as far as what they totally accomplished there?
Dash 4, yes.
Which really does sum up what these options. Okay. All right. Do we have any questions here about the? All right, thank you very much. I'm pleased that you were able to get together on this. And at this time, I'd like to also ask Mr. Anton to come up and, Mr. Mann, if they wish to add to this discussion, do you have any? You're fine? All right. Good. And Mr. Seeley from DMD. Oh, I'm sorry. And there is a board member. Excuse me.
That would be me, Madam Chair.
Oh, I thought you meant someone else out in the audience.
No.
I'm sorry. Sorry. Yes?
If I may, the E&O insurance is pretty important. But we have people carrying E&O insurance who have to get a bond because of the language now. It's redundant, it's expensive, and it's unnecessary. If I may, now that you've already dropped A3, there is one issue in that, and I realize your legislative calendar is short. There's one issue in that, and that is the exemption for people employed by one employer. The board has been discussing and is concerned that what we are going to end up with is people, firms that will be saying that they're investigative firms specifically that will be saying their employees are exempt, or people getting a subchapter S that will say they're exempt because they are in fact employees. I realize again that your calendar is short, but I think there is board consensus on that issue. Mr. Antone has some objections based on some problems with larger detective agencies who also do security work, but I think generally speaking the board has a consensus on that issue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Montgomery.
Maybe I misunderstood some testimony earlier. I understood that the dash 4 and the dash 2 amendments everybody was agreeing on and all the ones we heard are not agreeing on.
No, excuse me. Excuse me for causing some confusion. 2 and 4 we do agree on. I'm sort of trying to bring up again 3 where there is some disagreement on some elements, but there is a particular issue that's important, I think, to the board. And I understand your timeline, and if you want to drop it in the interest of efficiency, I'd understand that also. But I feel compelled to mention that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gardner.
I was just going to ask you what your name is for the record.
Bruce Daly. I'm one of the investigative representative members of the board.
Any other questions?
Mr. Cruz's district.
I think we're under quite a time constraint.
I understand.
And as long as you have reached agreement on dash 2s, dash 4s, I'm willing to work on those. So...
Is there any further testimony, Madam Chair, that we...
All we have are here.
Okay.
Except for Mr. Seeley.
Okay, I was just ready to make a motion if you're ready.
Oh, I see. All right. I thought you wanted to hear from someone
else. No.
I have asked Mr. Seeley to come forward, and perhaps we need his comment here yet for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Seeley with Driver and Motor Vehicle Services Division of ODOT. Get that name right. Keep changing it. The A2 amendments have absolutely no effect on DMV. The A4 are just fine.
Okay.
They keep us in in concert with the financial security requirements, getting the license in the first place, and solves one of their problems and one of ours.
All right. Very good.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the dash A2 amendments.
All right. President Gardner has moved the dash 2s. Any objection? Hearing none. The dash 2s are moved. And we have the dash 4s.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the dash 4 amendments.
All right. Representative Gardner has moved the dash 4s. Do I hear an objection? If not, they are approved.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 202 as amended, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Gardner has moved Senate Bill 202A to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. And discussion? Not. Will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Gardner, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Knoll, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative Cruz?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Montgomery?
Aye.
Representative Pearson?
Aye.
Chair Loken?
Aye. All right. Senate Bill 202A, as amended, is passed to the floor, and we do need a carrier for that. Do I have anyone who is not turning their back?
Madam Chair, is this the last bill out of the committee?
I think, as far as I know, we're...
Well, then the chair...
I believe the chair should care.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
Oh, Terry. Thank you very much. As far as I know, unless we get a surprise today, but all right, thank you. That closes the work session, and if the committee wishes, the chair wishes to have a meeting and get together on here on Thursday morning, just to close, just to see if there are any ends to tie up. And then, if not, we can assume that the speaker will have us close this committee and have our work done. But thank you very much, and thank you. And we'll now adjourn the meeting.
Madam Chair, can we re-unadjourn and let me vote on 197?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, gosh, how do we do this? Open the hearing, or the work session on... 197.
Madam Chair, I'd move for suspension of the rules to allow Representative Lowe to vote on what bill was?
197.
197.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
How do you vote?
Aye.
All right.
Thank
That'll
you.
Be it. Does not change the outcome. Excellent.
We're adjourning.
We're adjourned.
Oh, all right.
I don't think so. You shouldn't tempt me with you.